this truth of the head. It gets beyond all the headlines you read. Don't need lip service with a wink and a nod. You need a man on a mission from God. Well, not to worry, here's Bob Kenyon-Lite.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Kenyon-Lite. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday, a special edition where we will continue our discussion about comets. One of my favorite people to listen to about comets or about all things science is a Navy guy who had quite a career in the Navy's nuclear program. Kevin Lee was accepted into the Navy nuclear power program. After serving on a nuclear submarine, he went on to work in the nuclear engineering department of the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard. He was an instructor there and was part of a think tank called the Nuclear Improvements Group. Kevin earned recognition as Employee of the Year out of 12,000 workers. So, Kevin Lee, welcome back to Bob Kenyon-Lite Live.
Bob, great to be back again.
Thank you so much. So many people have told me that they really enjoyed our discussion last Friday on comets, and today we want to take that a lot further to how do we know that the Big Bang theory of comets' origins is unworkable and how we know as Bible-believing Christians where comets come from. But for a review, what is a comet, Kevin Lee? What's a comet?
Many people describe them as traveling through space at various different velocities, depending on how close they are to our sun, as just traveling in space, dirty snowballs.
Dirty, fluffy snowballs.
Fluffy, 38% of the mass of a typical comet is water, frozen water. Extremely fluffy. As it approaches the sun, it gives off vents that allow us to see the tail. And most people think, wow, what's that tail? Well, it's really very minuscule particles. As you mentioned last week, 100 cubic miles of Halley's Comet tail contained less matter than a cubic inch of air that we're breathing right now.
And the tails are also, could be hundreds of millions of miles, right?
Right. Exactly. One of the tails is 3.4 astronomical units, meaning it's 3.4 times the distance between the sun and the Earth. So when we see them painted across the sky, those tails, they're millions and millions of miles long.
And they're not very strong. I said a fluffy, dirty snowball. They're about the strength of meringue on a lemon meringue pie. The speed of comets, they go as fast as 350 miles per second when they're near the sun and going around the sun, slingshotting around the sun. And then when they're up at the far reaches of their orbit, furthest from the sun, they slow down to as slow as 15 miles per hour. And they stay at that slow speed for years, and then they start to fall back to the sun. Their composition, what they're made up of, is shocking. In fact, I have a quote from a scientist we could talk about more in a moment, Don Brownlee, who is a principal scientist for the Stardust mission. And he said how material from the inner solar system could have ended up in comets is a mystery, but what is it that comets are made up of other than the water? What is in comets?
Well, they find organic molecules. They've even recently gone public, as we mentioned last week, to have discovered amino acids. An amino acid, which is Dr. Brownlee on the phone with me, admitted he was shocked. We had a conversation, I think it was back in August. Last year, he's surprised. Amino acids, crystalline minerals that can only form in the presence of high heat, in the presence of water, other things that can only be formed in the presence of liquid water, limestone. These other things are found in comet tails. Dust that was brought back by Stardust or by light spectrometry, they know that there's cellulose, the organic cellulose, which is what are trees, one of the compounds of trees. So
we have in comets, we have things like calcium carbonates, which are limestone, and clays. These are things that form in liquid water. They form only in liquid water. We have crystalline silicates like olivine, which is the most common mineral on Earth. That's what we find in comets. We find organic material, sodium, dirt, Hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen. We find methane and ethane, which on Earth are produced by bacteria. So everything we find in a comet, that's the stuff you find on Earth.
That's correct. And in fact, everything that, you know, a statement has been made that everything we know about comets would testify to the fact that they came from Earth. And in fact, I made that comment to Dr. Brownlee on the phone call last year. And he didn't dispute that as being, again, like I said last week, as being an insane person. I said, but the hard part for you, Dr. Brownlee, to accept that is that where in the world could the energy have come to launch comets from Earth? Everything we know about comets is that they could have come from Earth, except for how preposterous it seems that the Earth could have ejected them from the gravitational force of the Earth to put them into highly elliptical orbits around the sun, which is exactly what would have happened had we ejected dirty water and minerals and compounds common to Earth, had the Earth somehow ejected that material into the solar system, escaping Earth's gravitational attraction by exceeding 7 miles per second. Everything that we now know about comets would exactly come from that scenario. And so I said, Dr. Brownlee, I know it's preposterous except for that, but there's a doctorate from MIT Mechanical Engineering, Dr. Walt Brown, that has come up with a theory that explains where the energy would come from to do that.
To launch comets into outer space from the Earth. And so, Dr. Brownlee, did you present to him Dr. Walt Brown's theory?
Yes, I had actually, at the end of the discussion, during the discussion, I said, so Dr. Brownlee, because you're so perplexed, because I heard you, 2 years earlier at the University of Washington give a lecture where you can't explain this, and now amino acids have been proven to have been captured by Stardust, and you're perplexed by that. So why don't you at least read Dr. Brown's book under your bed sheets at night. That's exactly what I told him on the phone. Just out of professional curiosity, just go hide yourself someplace and be found reading some creationist book. And he, at the end of the conversation, asked me to give him Dr. Walt Brown's website, www.creationscience.com. He wanted that address, presumably to go read it.
So if he read it, there are two families of comets, short-period and long-period comets. Kevin Lee, is it only creationists to point out that comets cannot survive for millions of years because of their orbit and when they pass by the sun and comet killers like Jupiter and so on?
Well, every evolutionary Big Banger scientist that has training in orbital physics, which Dr. Brownlee would fit into that, he's an orbital physics person. They realize that within 10,000 years, the evolutionists say within 10,000, the Jupiter family comets are going to be destroyed.
Within 10,000 years?
10,000 years, they're all gone. Walt Brown says 12,000.
We have these comets that the short-period comets orbit the sun once every 100 years. As they pass the sun's radiant energy, it causes them to lose mass, so they get smaller. And there's an effect of the inner planets, especially Jupiter's effect, is extraordinary on comets. And it can boost some of them, give them enough energy so that they leave the solar system forever. Others can smash into Jupiter. And so when you look at that, 100 times around the sun or so, and these comets will be gone. So they can't be here for millions of years.
And it's actually worse than that, because what we're talking about is Jupiter's family will be gone in 10 to 12,000 years. That's 120 out of the 205 short comets, which a short comet, again, defined by Walt Brown, is 100 years. The Big Bangers use 200 years. That's an arbitrary number that they came up with, but Walt further defines it less than 100 years for reasons that are clear in his book. But 120 of the 205 comets are Jupiter's family. They'll all be gone in 10,000 years. And it's worse than what you say. We have enough orbital information and data from these short-period comets, because they come in so frequently, that you can computer program into the future, knowing their orbits, knowing how close they're going to get to the different planets in the solar system during their orbits, that you can watch them on a computer be destroyed.
Mm.
It's just a simple fact.
Yeah, and this has been done. This has been done multiple times. Sophisticated computer simulation. I was in the simulation department of Martin Marietta's helicopter company on the Apache helicopter, and orbital mechanics are very well known. And so these comets cannot survive. So lo and behold, they're produced randomly, supposedly by an Oort cloud or a modified Oort cloud theory. And a shell around the solar system. But here we are in this brief moment of time, and we see these comets that can only survive for 10,000 years.
Yeah, and we don't have a viable, you know, they don't have a viable scientifically sound explanation based on evidence of how these short period, low energy comets can come into being. We don't have a way that they could be birthed. We don't see them being birthed. And yet the population that we have right now will be gone in 10,000 years. And they're supposing our solar system's been around for billions of years.
Billions of years.
They are in a very big scientific pickle, and they accuse us of being nutcases.
Right. And because, you know, they'll say that perhaps Mars once was flooded by water, when it's like the Sahara Desert on Mars, but the Earth, which is two-thirds covered with water miles deep, they say, oh, no, the Earth could never have been flooded by water. So that's what we put up with, and they say that our understanding is unreasonable.
Yeah, and just as an example, the Stardust Project that was, again, the brains behind it was Dr. Don Brownlee that you've mentioned. The reason why he started the project was because a comet that was a short-period comet that was not part of Jupiter's family, when it was coming in, it got close to Jupiter, and the perturbation of the gravitational attraction of Jupiter on that comet altered its orbit, sucked it in closer to the solar system, closer to us, to where we could send a spacecraft to it, and closer to Jupiter. It sucked that comet into Jupiter's family. So one of the short-period comets that was not part of the family that was going to be destroyed in 10,000 years got sucked up into the family that's going to be destroyed in 2,000 years, and that's what's going to happen to all the short-period comets.
Mm.
All of them, because they're coming into the solar system, are going to be perturbed by the gravitational attraction of the various planets and sun, and they're going to be killed.
They're going to be killed, yeah. And so now when we look at the moon, I might have mentioned this on last week's show, moon quakes, like earthquakes on Earth, on the moon, they're called moonquakes. Moonquakes happen on the near side of the moon, not on the far side. The near side of the moon has been pummeled far beyond what the far side has been hit with. And so that is additional evidence, aside from the composition and the orbits of comets, something was ejected from the Earth in the recent past that created the population of comets. So let's discuss now the hydroplate theory, which is Walt Brown's theory, and it comes from Genesis chapter 1, that God made the earth, and he separated the waters under the firmament, under the crust of the earth, from the waters above the crust, so that before the global flood, there was a sphere of water on the earth below the surface, subterranean, about 10 miles deep. And the crust of the earth cracked, as the Bible says, the fountains of the great deep broke forth. And that crack in the crust of the earth, today we can see it when we look at a map of the ocean floor. The mid-oceanic ridge goes completely around the earth, like the seam on a baseball. When the crust of the earth cracked, there was so much convulsion on the earth that the forces were so enormous that there was enough energy to shoot water and debris, rock, dirt, up to escape Earth's velocity, meaning it has to be going at 7 miles per second, and that pummeled especially the near side of the moon. And some rock became meteorites, asteroids, and when there was enough water, these ejections became comets.
And I want to explain, your listeners probably are used to hearing that the firmament that separated the waters above and below the firmament, going to Henry Morris and others that have taught that that's some kind of vapor canopy.
Right.
There's strong indication that Walt points out in three pages of his book that maybe that's the wrong understanding, and that the firmament, what we call firmament, what New American Standard calls the expanse, was actually the crust.
The crust of the earth. In fact, on our website, kgov.com, we have an article, What is the Firmament of Genesis 1:8? And the firmament was the crust of the earth. And then later in Genesis 1, we read about the firmament of the heavens. And first there is the firmament, which is the crust of the earth, and then the firmament of the heavens, where you can see the stars through the firmament of the heavens. But yes, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think Walt's correct on that, but there's obviously debate among people that are trying to understand this. But then another correction, that water, it's not just that the water was under there and it had the energy to eject just from the weight of the cross.
Oh, no.
There is not enough energy to eject water with 7 miles per second to escape the earth with just,
right,
you know, coming out from underneath the crust. It heated up. Walt explains how this water went to supercritical temperature, meaning greater than 705 degrees, where water goes into another state. You know, normally people are associated with the states of water being solid, ice, liquid water, and then vaporous water.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a fourth state of water called supercritical water,
right,
which is at 705 degrees. And the water would have gotten hot by ways that Walt explains in his book, and then there would have been enough heat energy to cause water to be explosive, like dynamite, as it went from 60,000 pounds per square inch below the crust to atmospheric pressure, and it would have jettisoned with supersonic velocities from the earth. And that water was heated up by other processes that we can get into sometime, but I wanted to correct one other thing, and that is that the crack in the crust is not the mid-oceanic ridge. The mid-oceanic ridge is the scar left on what was the floor of this water chamber, which Walt calls the subterranean water chamber, had a floor to it. And when the crust ruptured, it was then hydroblasted. It was the comets, the dirt part of the comets, were the crack of the crust being destroyed by the hydroblasting of this escaping fountain that was taking rocks and debris up into space with the jettisoning water. Would have widened the crack hundreds of miles, and then the floor of the chamber would have pushed up into that crack, and the shape of the mid-oceanic ridge is that movement of the mantle, pre-flood mantle, up into that crack, and that's the ridge that we see. So the ridge is close to where the crack in the crust had been before the ridge moved up into that crack, causing the continents to move away and compress in what
Okay.
Dr. Brown calls compression event.
All right. So, and thank you for all these clarifications. You know, I'm dangerous as a talk show host. I just...
That's okay.
I just give the layman's view.
It's a confusing topic, and it's difficult to get our minds around.
Yeah. So the theory is that at the global flood, the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the crust of the earth cracked, and the subterranean shell of water on the earth began to escape onto the surface of the earth. And much of that, because of the energy that was released in the subterranean chamber, some of that matter was expelled from the earth. It reached escape velocity and went out into space. Some of it hit the moon. Some of it hit Mars. Some of it became asteroids, small rocks, meteors, and when there was enough water, it was heading out in like pulsating from the earth, water and rock, debris, and it gravitationally attracted because it was all going at the same direction, at the same speed, and that became comets.
That exactly, and some of the water that didn't escape, didn't get jettisoned from the earth with the velocity necessary to escape Earth's gravity, fell back down to Earth. Mm. And there happens to be a very reliable source of history dating back to antiquity that talks about 40 days and 40 nights of global rainfall.
Mm.
And see, if there was a fountain that erupted from subterranean waters in a global crack that would have gone all the way around the world, you would have created a global fountain that would have sent water up into the atmosphere, some of it not escaping Earth's gravity and falling back down globally.
So the rain for 40 days and 40 nights was the water just jettisoned up into the atmosphere from the fountains of the Great Deep that fell back down.
That, correct. And some people might be thinking, rightfully so, inquisitive minds out there, that, well, Kevin, you said that that water was 700 and some degrees and higher. Actually, it was much higher than that. And how did that come back and not burn everybody? Well, because those supercritical water are just little packets of liquid molecular water that instantly can flash into steam. They go from steam to just vapor to liquid packets, and when you release the pressure on it, it explodes violently into just gas. And everybody that has looked at, even briefly, at gas laws, even weathermen know about it. When the air is traveling to the Rocky Mountains and it comes up and over the Rocky Mountains, it gets colder. You depressurize a gas, and it becomes colder. So the gas would have come up, depressurized, lost its thermal energy into kinetic energy, and some of that would have gone up into space and fallen down, being super frozen crystals that would have buried mammoths.
Woolly mammoths, for example.
Have buried woolly mammoths.
And Walt Brown's prediction, Kevin, that we will never find fossils below woolly mammoths because they were killed as a result of the flood. I mean, that's an example of fascinating predictions that fill Walt Brown's book in the beginning.
Yeah, and actually, the distinction has to be a little bit narrower than that. There will never be found a fossil or fossil layer directly below a frozen and especially standing up woolly mammoth.
Right, which they find.
Standing up woolly mammoth.
Right, right.
And the most famous woolly mammoth was discovered frozen solid standing up with broken legs, broken ribs. Vegetation still in its mouth, vegetation in its stomach that doesn't even grow in the Arctic Circle.
Right.
How did this animal get broken bones that had no indication of any, Mr. Caveman going up there and smacking him with a baseball bat
on the
outside of his skin?
So we only have another few minutes, but for example, there are many other observations that bring credibility to this theory that water and dirt and rock was ejected from the Earth into the upper atmosphere, which flooded the Earth, and much of that left our planet and became the meteorites, asteroids, and comets of the solar system. And as we've discussed, because of Jupiter, the effect of the sun, the effect of the planets, these comets, short-period comets, they simply can't survive for millions of years. So this is evidence that they are very young, and they look exactly like they came from the Earth. And the Bible describes, and Walt Brown's hydroplate theory explains, the mechanism of how they were ejected from the Earth.
Very true.
Now let me ask you this last question about comets. The short period ones, that less than 100 years, almost all of them, there are 200 of them, almost all of them have prograde orbit around the Earth and around the sun. In other words, they travel around the sun in the same direction as the Earth. Is that true?
That is true. And that is not what you would expect if they were randomly coming in from an Oort cloud. It's contrary to what you would think.
And as you have told me, when we launch rockets to outer space, we do so from Cape Canaveral because Cape Canaveral is closer to the equator. So it's traveling faster than, say, from New York up closer to the North Pole. So comets, when they were launched from the Earth, they took advantage of the Earth's orbit around the sun. And comets that just barely escaped the Earth's gravity, they became the short period, and they're traveling, almost all of them, in the same direction as the Earth is, where comets that were launched with more energy, they're a long period. And about half of them are retrograde. They're traveling in the opposite direction of the Earth.
That's right. Half of them are retrograde, half of them are prograde, and evolutionary big bangers think that the short periods were somehow, even though they can't explain it, somehow changed to short periods from being long periods, and you can't explain that by orbital physics. And if that were true, half of them would be prograde, half of them would be retrograde. That is not what the evidence, the scientific evidence, shows.
Wow. So, Kevin Lee, we're out of time, but what an honor. And if people want to find out about work that you've done in the creation movement, could you give us a website in our last 15 seconds?
We're a church. The preponderance of what we post are verse-by-verse studies through the Bible. We have the whole Old and New Testament, but our website is www.calvarypo.org.
Calvary, Port Orchard in Washington, calvarypo.org. Pastor Kevin Lee, thank you. What an honor to have you on the show.
Great being here, Bob, and God bless you.
God bless you. Maranatha Christian Center, what a great school, and our website is kgov.com.